Yesterday evening, Lal Gopal made a suggestion that we continue Vaikuntha part 2. Would you like to hear about Vaikuntha? So there's a very wonderful description of Vaikuntha that we read last night in the Srimad Bhagavatam. That's the four Kumaras entrance just at the gate of Vaikuntha, but they didn't go in. So in Brihat Bhagavatamrita, Gopal Kumar passes through the seven gates and he goes in. Past the seventh gate. Right to the throne of Lord Narayan, and he meets him. More than he meets him, the Lord stands and runs to receive him. So I'd like to just read the description. Brihat Bhagavatamrita is not fiction. Brihat Bhagavatamrita is a commentary. Well, at the very beginning of Brihat Bhagavatamrita part 1, it's a narration of first the son of Maharaj Parikshit's name was Janamejaya, right? When Maharaj Parikshit was cursed to die by the bite of a snake bird, he turned over his kingdom to his son Janamejaya. So Janamejaya, his father was Maharaj Parikshit, whose father was Abhimanyu, whose father was Arjuna. So his ancestry is contemptuous. Three generations previous, he was a descendant of the dearmost family to Lord Krishna, the Pandavas. And he was hearing a description of Mahabharata, different than Vyasadeva's Mahabharata, another Mahabharata, Jaimini Rishi's Mahabharata. Just like there's different Ramayans. So we particularly honor and appreciate Valmiki Ramayana, but there's many different Ramayans. There's many different Ramayans that are even mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam. In the ninth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, when Shukadeva Goswami comes to the chapter where he's going to narrate the pastimes of Lord Ram, he says there are many versions of Ramayana, and I'm only going to speak from the authoritative ones, meaning even then there were unauthoritative ones. So what to speak of, as Kali Yuga has advanced, there's too many unauthoritative ones. So different authoritative Mahabharatas also. Jaimini was narrating one of them. And the narration was so relishable. Janamejaya said, I've heard many times Mahabharata, but never as sweet as this. Is there a corollary literature that explains that Mahabharata version? And he said, yes. And I'll explain it to you. And it begins like this. One day, and that's how the beginning of part one. One day, Narada Muni was by the side of a very sacred kund, Dashashvamedha Ghat, with a group of sages in the month of Magh, and they were observing a month-long ritual, reading from the Vedas, how glorious it was to do the particular austerity that they were doing during that particular month at that particular place, and such benefit would be derived for those who were performing that particular activity. And as sages do, when sages get together, they don't talk about politics or newspapers or what's happening in the stock market. They were talking about the pastimes of the personality of Godhead and the supreme wonder of spiritual attainment. So they started speaking about who is the most, we're receiving so much mercy, but who is the greatest recipient of mercy of the Lord? And as they were speaking, Narada became very enlivened. And so that continues from there. We'll narrate the whole. He goes through a series of places, one after the next, 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 going to one person who is named as the greatest recipient of the mercy of the Lord. When he goes there, he sees it's true. He's such a recipient of the mercy of the Lord, and he glorifies that person. And the person's going, no, 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 no. You don't understand. These are all my bad qualities and misfortunes and disqualifications. They would deprecate themselves in great humility. But then they would point to someone who is really a great recipient of the mercy of the Lord, much, much, much greater than me. And hearing their glories, Narada would go to that person, and sure enough, they were, and he would extol their glories, and they would say, no, 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 you don't understand. Speaking in great humility, because that was part of their greatness. And on and on and on until the final stage, where the greatest recipient turns out to be the residents of Vrindavan. And it's a very amazing description of how that comes about. But the glories of the residents of Vrindavan, and especially the glories of the gopis who are residents in Vrindavan. Their love for Krishna is unparalleled. And that part one ends, and part two begins with the author, Sanatana Goswami, saying, this was just a warm-up. This was just a summary of the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, the importance of receiving the mercy of the Lord, and who is most qualified and greatest recipients of the mercy of the Lord. Now we're going to begin Brihad Bhagavatamrita. And the scene of Brihad Bhagavatamrita opens with Gopa Kumar. We were asking the children yesterday, what does Kumar mean? And Triniti said, kid. A kid. So, 5 years old. Gopal Kumar, a little boy, cowherd boy, in Vrindavan, by Govardhan. That's where he was born and grew up. And he was a cowherd boy, so Gopal Kumar. And he, with a group of other cowherd boys, they were doing what cowherd boys do. They were tending the cows. And in the course of their living in Vrindavan, tending the cows, they noticed one very saintly amongst all the elder personalities, one very special saintly Brahmin. And Gopal Kumar became very attracted. So at the end of the day, he would go and sit with him and hear from him and serve him. And eventually Gopal Kumar asked, little 5-year-old boy, he asked this Brahmin, who would he initiate him into the sacred mantra? And the Brahmin said, yes, you go take your bath in the Jamuna, come back, and I'll give you this mantra. So that happened, and he gave him mantra. And he was in such a state of ecstatic bhakti that when he gave him the mantra, he swooned and fainted to the ground. And Gopa Kumar was very worried. Is he all right? Is everything all right? So, can we move in? Because the refrigerator is too tall to sit on. Some persons don't want to give up the back row seat. What can we do? Okay. I forget the plot, the details of what happened, but the Brahmin disappeared. Just like poof, he disappeared. But Gopa Kumar took his initiation seriously, and he was very conscientiously chanting his mantra. The thing was, he didn't know anything about what the mantra meant. He didn't know anything about how to chant it. Should I chant it out loud? Should I chant it silently? Should I chant it all the time? Should I chant it some of the time? No instruction. Just he received the mantra. And throughout the whole, like, two volumes this big, Gopa Kumar is being carried by his faith in the mantra through all kinds of circumstances. Different planets within this world. He goes through the seven layers of the universe, and that's a really far out description. It's not like, you know, hard crusty layers. It's something else, very, very amazing. And into the vastness of the spiritual sky, he encounters the impersonal merging with the oneness allure. He goes, no, that's not Madan Gopal. No, and it goes away, and then it comes again, and no, Madan Gopal, and it goes away. It's like amazing. Then he comes back, and then he's transported to Vaikuntha. So that's where we are. We're going to be reading about Gopa Kumar at the gates of Vaikuntha. He's being taken there by the Vaikuntha Dutas. Just like in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, where the Yama Dutas come and then the Vishnu Dutas come, when Ajamila chants Narayana. And they're described in an identical manner. Then there's another place in the fourth canto where Dhruva Maharaj, at the end of his life, a Vaikuntha Vimana descends, and the Vaikuntha residents invite him to come with them to the spiritual world. Remember that description? He does his, before he gets on the Vimana, he purifies himself and does his practices for purification, circumambulates the Vimana three times, and he goes to step on the Vimana, and death personified approaches him, and he steps on the head of death and gets on the Vimana. Then he says, wait, I can't leave without my mother. And the Vaikuntha Dutas gesture to the other Vimana and say, there's your mother. Because of you, she's also been delivered. And off they go to Vaikuntha. But it doesn't describe what Vaikuntha is. Here's a description of Vaikuntha. The Vaikuntha dutas are taking, because of his great faith in mantra, in his Madan Gopal mantra, and his fastidious chanting in that faithful condition, he's taken to the spiritual world. Would you like to hear what the spiritual world looks like? Well, I'll summarize at the very beginning where at that moment the associates of the Lord arrived in an airplane to take me to Vaikuntha. This is Gopakumar speaking to a Brahmin who came to him with some questions. And he said, to answer your question, I'm going to describe, one does not do this, talk about oneself. But I can't think of a better way to describe than these series of events that happened to me. So I'm going to describe to you what happened to me. The Lord's associates at once put me on that plane and carried me away. And when I opened my eyes, I saw that everything was different. Shocked. I returned to full consciousness and saw that beside me, the same benefactors I had met before. The plane upon which they rode was wonderful, incomparable, indescribably beautiful, excelling in brilliance the most powerful luminaries. As I reverently offered obeisances, those associates of the Lord embraced me and reassured me again and again. Putting forward hundreds of arguments, they wished to give me a bodily form like theirs for entrance into Vaikuntha. But I refused. And instead, by their influence, by my own body, born in Govardhan, assumed qualities and beauty like theirs. He liked his cowherd boy form and his dress. Because later he gets teased about the way that your dress doesn't fit, Vaikuntha. It's just not the fashion here. You should dress properly. He said, no, I don't want to dress. I like this dress. In their company, I traveled along the path to Vaikuntha, a path inconceivable, supremely blissful, and distant from everything in this world. My eyes fell upon all those worlds, cosmic regions, and coverings of the universe I had visited before, and I felt ashamed. The residents and presiding rulers of those places were honoring me, faces upraised, he's like, palms joined above their heads. They vigorously cast flowers, parched rice, and other auspicious offerings upwards towards me, praises, crying, victory, and offering obeisances at every step. I moved on, and before my eyes I saw the abode of liberation and how trifling it was, Sayuja, the realm of oneness. And traveling upward from there, I came to the world of Lord Shiva. There I bowed down to Shiva and Uma with great pleasure. And he made me feel blissful with the flood of gracious words, filled with love and respect. And then I went on to that place whose garland of glories cannot be touched by words or by the mind, Vaikuntha. Now there's an earlier section where he has met all these different personalities in different places, including Lord Shiva. And in that section it describes there are different abodes of Lord Shiva. Some are in lower regions, some are in the heavenly regions, some are beyond the universe in this Shiva Loka region, because there are different aspects of Lord Shiva and it's very complex and I'm not going to go into it. But above that Shiva Loka is Vaikuntha Loka. The associates of the Lord told me, please wait here for a moment outside. We should take permission from our Lord before bringing you into his city. And the commentary says that's standard etiquette. You don't just enter into the Lord's abode, you get permission. So they went to get permission. So he's outside the first of the seven gates. Yesterday evening we heard of the seventh gate. So he's outside the first. Here's their instruction. Stay calm. And with your eyes illumined by devotion for the Lord, count the waves of the vast ocean of wonders that flow here, one after another. Wonders you have never seen or heard before. Sri Gopal Kumar said, they went in, and I stood outside in the pavilion of the entrance gate. Pavilion of the entrance gate. You know what a pavilion is? So there's an entrance gate in some area, canopy-like area, and there he was. I then beheld someone coming and entering that great city. He rode on a transcendental vehicle endowed with the opulence of hundreds of universes. Music and other entertainment filled him with delight. He resembled the Supreme Lord in luster and beauty. I thought, he was Sri Hari, and I cried out again and again, O Lord, protect me, and bowed down to him. But he covered both his ears and gestured for me to stop. I'm a servant. I'm a servant of the servants. And he moved into the city. A short while later, another person came, splendid with even more power and opulence. I looked at him and I thought, surely this must be the Lord of the universe. He must have gone somewhere as a pastime and now he's entering into his own abode. When that person saw me bowing down with gestures of reverence and offering him prayers, as I had honored the one before, he affectionately spoke to me the same way. No, I'm the servant. I'm the servant of the servant. And he entered the city. This continues many times. Many others came, some alone, others in pairs, and yet others in larger groups, and all of them, each more splendid than the last one, entering the city of the Lord. Seeing them as they passed by, I was immersed, as before, in an ocean of awe. Again and again I bowed down and offered prayers, and each time, again, they stopped me with nectarian affectionate words. Some of them carried various items for performing their service, and others simply hurried forward, intoxicated by tastes of the nectar of devotion. All had their minds and senses busily absorbed, each in his own service, and all were decorated with a myriad of pleasures from ecstatic worship of the Lord. He hasn't even gone in yet. offering obeisances, reciting prayers, and doing all sorts of wonderful things. These devotees, their every limb lending grace to their ornaments, looked fit to appear before their worshipable Lord. They extolled the wonder of the great pastimes of the Lord, the husband of Lakshmi, as if his pastimes were those of some all-victorious king, and they were eager to see the Lord's lotus feet. Some were with their families, some with an array of things, and others left their families and things outside. Some had absorbed all that they had into themselves. There's no purport. And like beggars without possessions, they came alone, immersed in the moods of devotional meditation. Some assumed different forms at different times, with all kinds of ornaments, bodily features, and ways of acting, all exceedingly attractive. Now here's something that you normally don't hear. Some appeared as humans, some as monkeys, demigods, demons, or sages. I'll read the purport. And some bore the signs of persons initiated into the behavior of the Varnashram system. So here's the commentary is also written by Sanatana Goswami and then translated and summarized by the translating team headed by Gopi Puranadana. Commentary. The residents of Vaikuntha are in fact purely transcendental persons. The substance of their bodies is unalloyed Satchitananda. So these residents never belong to the human or other material species, nor to the limited designations of varnas and ashrams. Still, for the Supreme Lord's pleasure, they may assume or relinquish any form at any time. Some of them therefore appeared before Gopakumar like members of the Vedic society, wearing the signs of particular ashrams and varnas. Some wore sacred threads like initiated brahmanas, indicating that they chanted mantras for worshipping the Lord. And they carried kusha grass and kamandalus in their hands, and wore tulsi malas on their necks, and had tilak on their foreheads. Text 38. Some looked like Indra, Chandra, or other demigods. Some had three eyes, or four heads, or four arms, or eight, or 1,000 faces. That's not a normal description of Vaikuntha. It's four arms and looking like Lord Narayan. Here's Brihad Bhagavatamrita's explanation. This is the commentary. Some of the Vaikuntha residents looked like the King of Heaven, Indra, with 1,000 eyes on their bodies and thunderbolt weapons in their hands. Others appeared like gods of the moon, sun, fire, and wind. These demigods, headed by Indra, are not actually incarnations of the Supreme Lord, like Shiva and Brahma, who are especially empowered guna avatars. If required, for the service of Lord Narayan, the Vaikuntha Vasis can assume the exact forms of ordinary demigods. But empowered incarnations and direct expansions of Narayana, such as Anantashesh, the Vaikuntha Vasis can only emulate to the extent of copying certain of their bodily features. Next text. Gopakumar says, later I shall explain to you the reason for this extreme variety of appearances, coming attractions. For those who enjoy the moods of devotion to Krishna, is there anything not beautiful? The residents of Vaikuntha transcend everything material. For persons within the material creation, the manifold glories of those residents, and of the Vaikuntha world, and its master, are beyond analogy and beyond the power of words to describe. Nonetheless, my dear Brahmana, you are a resident of the material world, and your intelligence is confined because you can only see matter. Therefore, I say, it is like this, and it is like that, so that by material examples you might understand various things more easily. May Lord Hari forgive this offense. It's poetry by metaphor and simile. It is like this, it is like that. But he's saying it's beyond the capacity of words to describe. But just to give some indication, it's in that direction. Then he says, though there seem to be hierarchies in Vaikuntha, its residents all enjoy equality among themselves. In this, there is no contradiction. Variety without hierarchy. That, you know, the material world, that's not the way it works. But in the spiritual world, that's the way it works, and here's why. Absent amongst them, residents of Vaikuntha, are faults like envy. And their innate good qualities shine forth by the thousands. Just received a letter today from someone who is describing a whole bunch of things and a whole bunch of things and a whole bunch of things, and then like got down to what they really wanted to communicate. I have so much envy in my heart. I look at these things, you know, they were appreciating and appreciating, and then, you know, what's behind that appreciation is there's some envy. I don't like it, but I don't know how to get rid of it. It's like very disturbing, and it disturbs others. What do I do? Go to Vaikuntha. Or by practice of devotional service, the natural attraction for Krishna awakens, and that envy becomes again restored or transformed to our Krishna consciousness. So that's what he's being said here. Envy and other bad qualities are absent, and the spiritual consciousness shines forth in qualities by the thousands. Superficially, those residents of Vaikuntha may appear like sense enjoyers of the material realm, but in fact, their feet are worshipped by liberated souls. Those devotees have attained the absolute limit of changelessness. That's an interesting statement. Ravindra Sarup Prabhu, one of our devotees, wrote an article once about time and, you know, the relativity of time and the contradiction, apparent contradiction, about time being needed for events like past, present, future. You need that kind of time to have events like, you know, here we are seated together, and sometime before we were somewhere else, and when we're done we're going somewhere else. So to have this event you need time. So what are events in the spiritual world where there's no time? So he takes you on a little journey of going know, through scales of time. And I'm not going to reproduce what he did, but it's scripturally based. And like in the Bhagavatam, it describes the smallest unit of time is what it takes for the sun to cross one atom. And it gives, you know, 1/875th or something like that of a second. Something like, larger number than that. Some large number. And then in the Bhagavatam, when you get 10 atoms together, then it's, you know, another Sanskrit term. This is not, you know, anyway, it's not modern science, it's the Bhagavatam. And you just keep doing the math. And there's a chart in the Bhagavatam, or in Prabhupada's purport, where, you know, you get a muhurta. Like we say, Brahma muhurta. It's so many of those times something. You know, it's time and space. Like time and space. Einstein's time-space relativity, right? Anyway, I'm not going to go into it too much. But you just keep going up in the planetary systems, and time gets closer to eternal. And you go further down and it gets more away from eternal to the lower planetary regions. But you know that we're in the middle planetary region where 6 months is one day in Swargaloka. And the night in Swargaloka makes another 6 months, so it's 1 year equals one day. But then it gives relative within the Vedas how much time in Swargaloka compared to Brahmaloka. And so forth. Like, you know, Brahma, we narrated on Sunday, the Brahma Vimohan Lila, where Brahma was for one moment attending to the cowherd boys in the cave, and he came back and 1 year had passed on earthly time. So time, you go back and back, and you get closer and closer and closer to Vaikuntha, and you reach eternal time, where it's the eternal present. And, you know, it's like, that's a cool phrase, eternal presence. But that's the spiritual world. And in that eternal presence, there's activity. But it's in the absence of time and the absence of space as we know it. You know, like, walk across the room and take a certain amount of time, you cover that much space, depending on how fast you walk. But in the spiritual world, time and space are, using Prabhupada's language, they're conspicuous by their absence. But there's still, you know, there's still activity. Like it says in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, in the spiritual world there's no need of sunlight or moonlight or electricity because everything there is self-luminous, correct? So there's no need, but there at the same time there's phases of the moon. Like Krishna's rasa dance takes place on the full moon night of the Sharad season. So how do you have a full moon if there's no moon? And how do you have day and night if there's no sun? Because the answer is by Krishna's internal potency that there is an appearance of the sun, an appearance of the moon, and phases of the moon. But it's by his internal potency. And the external potency is a better reflection of the internal potency. And there's substance, but it's not like the thing that we know here. There's time, but where time is eternal. Anyway, fascinating. So that what is being said about Vaikuntha is those devotees have attained the absolute limit of changelessness, because change takes place through time. In the spiritual world, there's no change. So if you're an impersonalist, you go, yes, there's no change. Everything is one. And if you're a Vaishnav, yes, there's no change, and there's all variety. Follow? And that's the experience of one who has heard, received knowledge from the disciplic succession. One who has not received knowledge from the disciplic succession, if you become spiritually advanced, you speculate that this changelessness means the state of oneness. Kevala Dvaita. Become an impersonalist. But Vaikuntha is not an impersonal, it's a the most personal place. Where there's variety but no but there's changelessness. There's events but no past, present, and future. It's inconceivable. But it's being described. Again, those devotees have attained the absolute limit of changelessness, yet they playfully show all kinds of transformations while taking part in the Lord's pastimes. Thus, although equals, they manifest individual variety. In that place, everything is so, including the profusion of airplanes. Sometimes that place appears full of riches like gold and jewels, and sometimes its atmosphere appears chalk white like a thick condensation of moonlight. Again, it's a metaphor. Think of moonlight. Think of concentrated moonlight. Think of thick, concentrated, condensed moonlight. And sometimes Vaikuntha is like that. And sometimes it appears full of riches like gold and jewels. Vaikuntha may be somehow understood only by its own spiritual influence and not otherwise. Indeed, the mind cannot grasp its form. He's trying to explain to the Brahmana what his experience of Vaikuntha was, and it's challenging using worldly examples. Chalk white, like thick condensation of moonlight. Amazing. Except by direct experience, no one can rightly understand Vaikuntha. No more than this can I accurately describe. When one sees those splendors of Vaikuntha, the happiness realized in the Brahman at once seems empty, as if from sheer embarrassment on its own it disappears. Those who are self-satisfied, fulfilled in all desires, and free from all material concerns, who have renounced everything they know and possess, who have associated with Vaishnavas and have thus acquired the power to discern between the essential and the non-essential. It is they who enter the path of devotional service. When I went to Vaikuntha, that is what I vividly saw. This is a nice literature. As I watched those persons come and go, I thought, what kind of Lord must it be who has such servants? Thus I thrilled with delight as I waited at the gateway up to Vaikuntha. I excitedly stood up and then sat down and stood up and sat down till the associates of the Lord returned rushing back and escorted me inside. The amazing things I then saw
more wonderful than wonderful. Even the thousand-headed Anantashesh would be unable to describe, even in the lifetime of Brahma. I arrived at several more gates, one after another, and at each one I was met by similar doorkeepers who allowed me to enter only after announcing my arrival to their immediate superiors. Having explained that they're all equals. They're just doing services. As I entered each gate, I saw the guards offer obeisances to the local superintendent. So I assumed that he was the Lord of the universe, overwhelmed with reverence, just as before I repeatedly bowed down and recited prayers. Finally, the Supreme Lord's compassionate men were guiding me, told me the special signs by which to recognize the Lord. They also taught me what prayers to recite and what etiquette to observe. He's like a little five-year-old boy from Govardhan getting an education and how to behave in Vaikuntha. Here's the commentary. Gopal Kumar's escorts informed him that the unique visible signs of Lord Narayan, like the Shrivatsa mark on his chest, apart from these few special features, the Lord of Vaikuntha is indistinguishable from his devotees, who show the perfection of Svarupya. Out of genuine sympathy for Gopal Kumar, his guides taught him how to behave in front of Lord Narayan. First, bow down, and then stand some distance aside, palms joined, look down at the Lord's lotus feet. Refrain from moving or displaying bodily transformations and so on. Like, you know, little etiquette class. Because they're bringing him before the Lord and they don't want him to blow it. He blows it. I passed rapidly through many districts, wonderfully splendid, with all kinds of houses and gates. And then I entered the most excellent transcendental neighborhood. There I came to one palace at whose feet many others stood in attendance, a palace district, overflowing with greatness, where excellence seemed to reach its highest limit. Radiant like millions of suns and moons, it captured my mind and my eyes. Within that palace, I saw before me at a distance the personality of Godhead, Lord of Vaikuntha. He sat at leisure on the best of royal thrones, a golden throne, shimmering with the glow of many jewels. The cushion on which he sat was of swan-like cotton, fine, attractive, spotlessly clean, and the soft, handsome bolster on which he leaned his left elbow and upper arm appeared like the full moon cleansed of its spots. He was the presiding Lord of blossoming youth. The brilliant effulgence of his sweet attractive limbs defeated the splendor of new rain clouds. That effulgence lent further grace to his garlands, cosmetics, and garments, already graced by jewelry made of gold bedecked with gems. His four shining arms, long and well built, enhanced the beauty of his bangles and armlets. Two yellow silk garments dressed his body, and charming earrings set off his rounded cheeks. On his broad chest was the Kastuba jewel, and on his conch shell neck a string of pearls, and on his moon-like face was a nectarian smile. His lotus eyes were alive with playful glances. The great
compassion he felt made his beautiful eyebrows dance. Rama, his ideally matching consort, standing by his left side, reverently offered him excellent pan to chew, which he accepted. The color of that pan made his bimba fruit lips even more attractive, and their luster reflected on his teeth, two rows of spotless kunda flowers. Illuminated by the glow of those flowers, his playful smile shone splendidly. His amusing words and gestures stole away the hearts of his devotees. The purport says a kunda flower is a small, pure white jasmine. The goddess Dharani, holding in her hand a vessel to catch the remnants of betel nut, constantly worshipped the Lord with messages in sidelong glances. And the Lord's excellent weapons, like Sudarshana, served him in beautiful personified forms, their identities marked by symbols on their heads. Servants stood all around him, worshipping him with great respect, their appearance like his, their hands beautified by the transcendental items which they held for his service, like slippers and yak-tail fans. Shesha, Garuda, Vishvaksena, and the other leaders of his many groups of attendants bowed down before him with devotion, stood before him with palms joined above their heads, and praised him in wonderful poetic language. Sri Narada's dancing and his expert singing and veena playing created such clever entertainment that the Lord and his consorts Rama and Dharani sometimes laughed out loud. To add to this special ecstasy of his devotees, whose hearts were fixed only on him, from time to time the Lord extended both his lotus feet as a way of offering himself. In this way, he exhibited his splendor. Gopal Kumar is going to lose it. The fullness of the ecstasy this sight brought on me made me forget what the attendants of the Lord had instructed me. You know, the etiquette. I cried out again and again, "Oh, Gopal! My life and soul!" And I ran forward to embrace the Lord. Some discerning attendants who were standing at the Lord's side held me back, and I was heartbroken. I cried out in helpless distress again and again, "Oh, Gopal, my life and soul!" Overcome by my own excessive love, and fell unconscious in front of the Lord. With some effort, those attendants lifted me up, and after some time I regained consciousness. I wiped away with my hands the flood of tears that blocked my sight, and with difficulty I finally opened my eyes. Then I heard the Lord, that best of merciful persons, tell me in a deep, gentle voice, "Please come back to your senses. Dear boy, come here quickly." Then I felt the highest limit of joy. I danced all around as if seized by madness and stumbled about. But with great endeavor, the Lord's servants calmed me down, and at last I wakened from that trance. The Supreme Lord said, listen to this, "Welcome. Welcome, my dear boy. I am fortunate. Most fortunate to meet you here. For so long I have been eager to see you." Think of this when you're chanting japa tomorrow morning. My dear friend, you have passed many lifetimes without paying any attention to me at all. For so long, hope had me dancing like a fool, thinking, perhaps in this lifetime, or this, he will finally turn his face toward me. But I could find no pretext on which to bring you here to my abode, dear brother, and still follow the timeless laws that I have created myself. You showed me no mercy. And as I considered this, I grew impatient, full of anxiety to receive your favor. So I transgressed my eternal code of conduct and arranged for you to take your current birth, dear boy, in that divine district of Govardhan, my most beloved abode. I myself became your guru, known by the name Jayanta. He's now for the first time hearing the name of his guru. He didn't even know his name. Because that Brahmin that I had mentioned, the Lord came himself. The Lord continued, today you have at last fulfilled the desire I have harbored for so long. Please nourish your happiness and mine by staying here forever. Commentary. Here the Lord says, in all humility, quote, what good have I ever done for you? But you have done the greatest good for me by coming here, unquote. The Lord hopes that Gopal Kumar will forget the discontentment that has impelled him to wander from one place to another and will instead choose to remain in Vaikuntha. Gopal Kumar said to the Brahmin, maddened by drinking the beverage of the Supreme Lord's words, so intoxicating, I was unable to offer him praise or to understand or do anything. Just in front of us appeared a number of flute players dressed as coward boys like me. They were very affectionately encouraging me, gained my trust, and pulled me into their midst and urged me to play my flute. So in various styles I played this very dear flute of mine, born on Govardhan Hill, and in this way I satisfied the ocean of all skillful arts, the reservoir of all mercy, Sri Madhava, along with his associates. When the time came to stop, everyone, on the request of Lakshmi Devi, started to leave. But I didn't want to go. The devotees had to persuade me to let them escort me outside. Though, like everyone else in Vaikuntha, I was approached by transcendental opulences, I avoided them. I refused to show even the splendors that spontaneously appeared within me. I resided there in the same form I had always had, that of a cowherd boy. In Vaikuntha, all opulences are purely spiritual, full in eternity knowledge and bliss, appearing whenever one desires. They willingly submit themselves to one's control. Thus, there is opulence even in what seems like its absence. And when opulence is visible, the devotees still feel as if they possess nothing. That is the special nature of Vaikuntha. In any case,
by the strong influence of the previous practice, I continued to pay serious attention to my worship of the Supreme Lord and always happily behaved like an insignificant person. In my heart, I then concluded that by the great mercy of the Lord, I had now surely gained the ultimate fruit to be acquired from all my prior births and endeavors. Oh, what unimaginable happiness! What an exalted abode! What a wonderful master! And how greatly wonderful his mercy! After some time, by the Lord's kindness, I obtained intimate personal service by fanning him with a chamara. And I constantly felt the bliss of seeing the Lord as I played for him on the flute. That's where I'm going to end reading. I'll just describe what comes up. His Gopal Kumar's Ishtadev is Madan Gopal. And while he's appreciating in so many ways, as we just heard, what Vaikuntha is like, was it Madan Gopal? And some other things. The residents of Vaikuntha were looking at his clothing saying, that's not the style here. Let's get you proper clothing for Vaikuntha. I like being a cowherd boy. I like my flute. I like Madan Gopal. And it somehow just wasn't right. It's Vaikuntha. But because of his particular form of love, that form of love in intimacy wasn't the same in Vaikuntha. There's not any flaw or imperfection, but it's the nature of his love and the object of his love, the love in intimacy. And that's one of the lessons of Srimad Bhagavatam, the teachings of Rupa Goswami and Lord Chaitanya following the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. Rupa Goswami uses this language, perfect, more perfect, and most perfect. So perfect is perfect. Nothing imperfect about perfect. But when intimacy becomes so strong that the opulence of the Supreme Lord is not even detected, like, for example, Krishna's lifting of Govardhan Hill. There's opulence. Little boy, 6 years old, lifting a hill. A mountain. I mean, you know, it takes so many hours just to walk around it. And he lifted it with one hand. Little boy. So he's showing his opulence of the personality of Godhead, Bhagavan. But they were unable to see that because their vision was so filled with their intimacy of love. They were just thinking, how wonderful is Krishna? Or Nanda Maharaj was thinking, he's a nice boy. He's thinking that he's lifting Govardhan Hill himself. But actually it's my strong arms lifting the hill with my cane. But that's okay, he can think like that. Because they're, or the other way around. When Krishna had killed Kamsa, after killing Kuvalyapida, huge,
huge elephant. It's like, you know, smacked him to the ground and broke off his tusks and smacked him with the tusks and killed him. Huge elephant. And he had one tusk and Balaram had the other tusk over their shoulder coming into the wrestling arena. And here are these huge mammoth wrestlers, killer wrestlers, Chanur and Mushtika. And 12-year-old boys finished him. And then their two brothers finished them. And Kamsa's sitting up on the throne, feeling fear. And the description, as Krishna's looking out the corner of his eye at Kamsa. The metaphor that's used is like a lusty boy is looking at a girl. He wanted to kill Kamsa. He jumped up on the throne and grabbed him and pulled him down to the wrestling arena and smashed him. And people were so afraid of Kamsa, he wanted to show that Kamsa was dead. So he took him by his hair and just dragged him across the wrestling arena. Kamsa's finished. But Krishna wanted to then free Vasudeva and Devaki because they were in Kamsa's prison. So they went to the prison. And when they came before Vasudeva and Devaki, because they heard everything that happened, their little boy just killed Kamsa. And previously, the last they had seen was when Krishna appeared in the prison house, and he was forearm Narayan. So they were filled with awe. But Krishna didn't want them to be filled with awe. He wanted them to embrace him, mother and father. So the Bhagavatam describes, he covered them with his yogamaya potency and they embraced him. They forgot that he was the personality of Godhead and just assumed the affection and love of parents for a small child. That's the Mathura mood. And then the Vrindavan mood is even more remote by not just being covered by Yogamaya to not be able to see that he's the personality of Godhead, but being overwhelmed with affection and love, intimate love. The cowherd boys wrestling with Krishna. Sridham, who is the elder brother of Srimati Radharani, he would regularly defeat Krishna. And he would say, what kind of big man are you? You're easily defeated in wrestling. Let's have a match right now. And he'd win. And then Krishna would lose. He'd have to carry Sridham on his shoulders because that's what happens when you lose. You carry the victor on your shoulders. He's the victor. Yay! Krishna's the loser. But the same Krishna who kills Aristashura and Kamsa and, you know, all the powerful demons, he's defeated by Sridham. And he's tied by a little rope by Mother Jasoda, crying, rubbing his eyes, with tears streaking down his cheeks, like a little baby, because of Mother Jasoda's motherly affection. So as mothers have affection for their small child, who can imagine the love of Mother Jasoda for Krishna? And Krishna is Bhaktavatsala. He's captured by that love. This is his chief quality. He's moved. He likes to be controlled. Just like yesterday we were discussing the four Kumaras and their cursing of Jayan Vijay. Jayan Vijay knew the Supreme Lord likes combat. He has this chivalrous spirit in him. He doesn't want to have anything to do with non-devotees. So as devotees, we'll take the position. Will be his competitor. He likes. The devotees like doing things that the Lord likes. And the Lord likes when the devotees like to do things. It's a loving relationship. It's inconceivable. In Vaikuntha, is there a mother of Lord Narayan? Who's the mother of Lord Narayan? But in Goloka, Mother Jasoda is the mother, and Nanda is the father. It's affection. It's lila. It's sweetness of intimacy. And so Gopal Kumar, when he goes from Vaikuntha, next stop is Ayodhya, where he finds the residents in Ayodhya are even more beautiful than in Vaikuntha. And he meets Hanuman, and it's a very nice description. The Vanaras try to steal his flute. He's very attached to his flute. He doesn't like that monkeys try to steal his flute. Anyway, wonderful description. Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So hearing such descriptions gives us, as Gopal Kumar says, something of an idea. From his side, he's asking for forgiveness for explaining something that's less than what it is. The description is less than what it is. But because he wants to help the Brahmin understand his actual spiritual position, he takes him through that exercise. And same Sanatana Goswami is writing for our purpose. It's something of an idea of the Lord of Vaikuntha and the residents in the Vaikuntha realm. What it's like to have opulences that just manifest and there's no attachment to them and they disappear and there's no lamentation, they've disappeared. It's incredible. The mood is simply service. And the Lord is enjoying in that atmosphere of service. And the servants are enjoying the fact that the Lord is enjoying in that atmosphere of service. And that's Vaikuntha. I hope there aren't any questions. Maybe there's some discussion. Any comments or discussion? Yes?
Krishna takes Arjuna during the Brahmana, he loses his child, baby every time.
Yeah.
So Arjuna says, I will bring back the baby. So Krishna takes Arjuna
to the abode of Mahavishnu.
Is it the same abode?
Well, it's spiritually non-different, but it's not the same. There's a translation of the word Kuntha I'm looking for right now, and I can't find it. But it's a slightly different word than Vaikuntha is without anxiety, and so Kuntha would naturally be anxiety. But there's another term that he translates Kuntha. Can't find it. Anything? Yes?
Maharaj, so it looks like there are innumerable Vaikuntha. So it means like there should be like innumerable Viraja Nadi.
Innumerable what?
Viraja Nadi. River, Viraja.
Viraja River.
Why do you say that? Are you speculating?
No, Maharaj, I was just usually, before reaching Vaikuntha, there is
Viraja
Nadi.
So, it's not like that. There is a region that's neither the spiritual world nor the material world. That's what Viraja is. So on the other side of the river Viraja is the spiritual world, the spiritual sky and the spiritual Vaikuntha planets. Okay?
So when in the Sri Sampradaya, when they say when the Vaishnava dies, they go to Vaikuntha, so it means like there is no any specific Vaikuntha, right? So I'm just asking if any.
They're all of the same absolute nature. So it's not like there's a Sri Vaishnava Vaikuntha planet or something. There's innumerable Vaikuntha planets. Don't try to penetrate beyond that with, you know, the tiny capacity of speculation. Don't go there. It's just unlimited spiritual planets. And one goes to whichever abode, whichever portion of that unlimited spiritual realm the Lord chooses to take one, and it's fine. Yes?
Maharaj, I heard that Hanuman stayed back here.
Yes.
How come he's there?
He's very perambulatory. He gets around. Just like when when Gopal Kumara is passing through Tapaloka, he sees the four Kumaras. When he gets to the Vaikuntha, he sees the four Kumaras and says, "Didn't I see you at Tapaloka? I've seen you somewhere before." Said, "Yes, we're actually residents of Vaikuntha. But we sometimes go there to give association." So, Hanuman remained behind, but at the same time, he's an eternal associate. So, he has the capacity for both. Yes?
And Gopal Kumar is my ultimate hero. And every time I hear him from you, it's so inspiring. His deep faith in the mantra and his, you had said at one of the festival holding retreats that he didn't want to be ungrateful to his spiritual master, but not realizing the fullness what a spiritual master wanted to bestow on him. So that deep love and that simplicity of heart is so inspiring. But it, every time I hear him, I get inspiration. Then there's, you know, periods of total forgetfulness. Would you recommend how I can keep up this inspiration?
Well, if you're those that inspire, then you hear about them, remember them, glorify them, pray to them, like that. So you can, from time to time, read, just like I did. It's been a long time since I've read this section. And certainly I don't even remember reading it aloud to a group like this, but in your home you have a copy, I imagine, and from, you know, you read sections a little bit. Don't make that your main manual, but, you know, from time to time you read a little bit and take inspiration. Just like I said, you know, when you're chanting your japa tomorrow morning, think about the Lord's feeling. You know, what are we feeling? Maybe not much, but he's feeling something. Maybe this time they'll come to me. Like that. So his eager anticipation, far more than our own. So it's then stay with that meditation for some time. Anything else? Yes.
But this is not related to this class, but since Srila Adiga Mataji raises the phrase simplicity of heart, so I am a little confused. Can you describe what is the simplicity of heart means?
Well, one way to understand something is to understand what it's not. So, what's the opposite of simplicity? One might be complexity, or another is duplicity, deception. Bhaktisiddhanta uses that meaning, that it's the chief quality, he says, of a brahmana, is that there's simplicity or straightforwardness, honesty as opposed to dishonesty or duplicity. So that's simplicity. You're in touch with what your feelings are, and you're expressing your feelings, and especially, you know, on the spiritual dimension, not just the material ones, but you're in touch with your spiritual feelings and you're emoting them or expressing them. And that's a simple heart. That's the platform of real satisfaction, the platform of complexity, bahusha kayanantascha, where that spiritual satisfaction is not tuned in, and yet I want happiness, and so I make so many plans for happiness. Makes for complexity. And it's also duplicity. It's not what real happiness is. And so I'm deceiving myself and trying to deceive others, neither of which are satisfying for myself or for others. And one whose heart is very simple, it's very pleasing to oneself and very pleasing to others. There's no other issues going on with a person whose heart is very simple and straightforward. The classic example of that simplicity and straightforwardness Bhaktisiddhanta refers to is Satyakama becoming a disciple of Gotama. Something like that happened, you know, some time ago, some place, I'm not going to say where, but someone came to see me, and the first time I had dialogue with them, and they were explaining their situation in their life, growing up, and in their marriage, and children, and, you know, the situation. And it was, they said a number of times that it was true. So this is very embarrassing. And then they proceeded to very clearly express that which was very embarrassing. You know, what their obstacles in their life are. So they're very much in touch and very straightforward. And their heart was simple, although the circumstance wasn't. For such a person, the light of mercy comes and illumines that darkness, so they can deal with it. Because otherwise, you know, the nature of what I was hearing was someone could be really in turmoil and in a bad state. They were dealing with it, and at the end of their description they said, "What do you think of me?" And I said, I'm feeling great compassion and empathy. I'm amazed at your quality of honesty and straightforwardness. And it's, you know, it's some other things that were said, but this is a very wonderful quality. the circumstances in your life that are obviously very difficult to deal with. But surely Krishna's mercy will be with you because you have that faith and you have that openness. Oh, that's simplicity. Even in the midst of complexity, simplicity. Heart. The world that we live in is a very complex place, and it's easy to get caught up in, like, you know, fending for yourself in this world of complexity and just getting sucked into the material energy, the place of complexity. Simplicity is one can Vyavasayatmika Bhuti Ekeha Kuranandana. Even in the midst of dealing with different things, there's one thing. Like this verse that we're discussing in the Bhagavatam class in the morning. Okay, anything else? Okay, do we have Radhanga now? We have Radhanga, look at that. Okay, let's have a little kirtan.